Dr. Wendy Suzuki is a professor of neuroscience and psychology in the Center for Neuroscience at New York University. Her major research interest includes brain plasticity, which of course is what I'm interested in. And this is her first fantastic book, and I hope there's many more to come. Healthy Brain, Happy Life. Dr. Suzuki, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much, Daniel. Wonderful to be here.
And thank you for this wonderful book, Healthy Brain, Happy Life, a personal program to activate your brain and do everything better. First of all, let me say, we don't usually do books like this, but the writing is so good and the narrative is so compelling, I thought I could teach this in an MFA class. So congratulations on this book.
Wow, that is really one of the nicest compliments I've ever gotten on this book. Thank you so much.
And I'm sure you're getting a lot of them because this book is doing very well from what I understand.
Yeah.
I think it's really striking a chord in a lot of readers.
Mm.
I want to start off with a question. You say towards the end of this book, you say in many ways this entire book is a narrative about my journey to find my own personal creative process. Can you explain this?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, well, first of all, that thought was inspired by the observation that I feel like I'm the most creative that I've ever been.
Right.
And why is that? It's because I am happier than I've ever been. I feel kind of good in my body. Mm-hmm. I feel good in my personal life. I feel good in my career. And I feel like a lot of worries and concerns have just been alleviated. And you need that kind of open brain space to create the things that you were meant to create. And one of the things that I talk about in the book is that this brain structure that I've studied for the last 20 years, it's critical for memory. It's called the hippocampus,
right.
The brain structure. We have two of them, one on the right, one on the left. It's not only important for memory and remembering things and the associations of things that we've experienced in the past, but it also seems important for putting novel things together in new ways, mm-hmm. that is imagination. Putting things that are already in your brain somehow, but putting them together in new ways. And a lot of what I talk about and a lot of what I've done is to do things that really enhance the hippocampus.
Right, right.
Exercise enhances the hippocampus. Meditation can enhance the hippocampus as well. So I've done kind of personal things and neurological things, I think, to enhance my life and also these brain structures that I think are critical for creativity.
You know, that's interesting because I've always, well, not always, but have known for a while that the hippocampus is where new memories are created, generated, where they begin. But one of the things that you're teaching us in this book, or teaching me at any rate, because I'm sure maybe neuroscientists have known this for a while, is that the hippocampus is also the place of the imagination, and that in many ways, remembering the past it requires the same brain area as remembering the past as it is to imagine the future.
Exactly.
And that's big.
Yeah, it is big, and it's not very well known. This is a brand new idea that was really surprising and continues to be surprising to a lot of neuroscientists because we thought we had the hippocampus down. We knew what it did. It helped us form new long-term memories,
right.
End of story, until a very clever neuroscientist at University College London, her name is Eleanor Maguire, asked a group of subjects who had damage to the hippocampus. She didn't ask them, can you remember things? We know that they didn't remember things well. She asked, can you imagine a situation that you've never experienced before? And that situation happened to be a tropical beach. These were all Londoners, and they had maybe been to a beach before, but not a tropical beach. And it was striking to read the narratives of what they came up with. They were so bland. They would say things like, well, there's water and there's sand, and that's about all I can tell you. Versus controls that were matched for education and age, who could, you know, come up with this great story about, you know, the fruity drink and
right.
All the boats that they saw and the palm trees and lots of details about what this tropical beach might look like, what they imagined it to look like. And that was the first clue,
right.
That the hippocampus was more than just for memory. And then others have followed up But I think that's just fascinating, and it's consistent with my own experience that exercise, which clearly improved my memory and a personal just observational level. Also, you can look at my teaching record at New York University, and kind of before I went through this transformation, you know, I was always a good teacher and standard kinds of classes. And after the transformation, I've been much more creative in the kinds of classes that I've developed, including classes where I bring exercise into the classroom, which was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you about that because it's fascinating, that class you taught. And as a professor here at the University of Texas, I try to teach what I'm learning. You say that a couple of times in this book. You say that, you know, a good professor knows that if you really want to learn something, teach it.
Exactly.
And I totally agree with that. But first, I want to linger a bit in memory and imagination and creativity itself. You know, as a writer, of course, I'm very interested in that. But in many ways, memory is how we define our lives. You know, we have our memories, and that's about it. And our memories, in many ways, the way we interpret them gives meaning to our reality. And if the same brain region is responsible for, you know, the creation of long-term memories as it is for the creation of imaginative scenarios, then does that link us to this idea that our imagination, the possibilities, the limits of our imagination in many ways contributes also to the way we receive or interpret reality?
Yeah, I absolutely think that. And I also want to point out that I'm not saying that the hippocampus is the only region important
absolutely.
For imagination.
Right.
It's been implicated. And so there's clearly many brain areas that will ultimately be identified as being important for imagination.
Right.
But I totally agree with your point that imagination will not only kind of bring us into the future and provide us with what the future can possibly be, but will absolutely color how we interpret our past. And I think we all know people that color their past in ways that we would never have.
Right.
The past, especially if we have the same, you know, experience with them. It's like, I don't remember that in the same way at all. So there's creative imagination at work.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that if we acknowledge that our imagination allows us access into our reality, that we can understand that if we're always imagining horrible, terrible things that are going to happen, we are going to, at least on some level, create that situation for ourselves. And I'm thinking specifically of an example that I thought was brilliant. And this is you and the doorman in your New York City apartment. You thought he hated you. And every day you had confirmation that he hated you because that was your fundamental belief, your imagination brought you there.
Yes.
But then what happened?
Well, I was working with a life coach, and they were going over kind of the tension-filled relationships in our experiences. And so the experience with the doorman that I was sure hated me came up. And the coach asked me a very, very powerful question. She said, "Have you ever asked him whether he hates you?" And I said, "No, I'm not going to ask him. I already know." And she said, are you sure? And I said, "Well, I'm pretty sure." And she said, I think you need to go and clear this up. And I think you need to go and ask him. And so with trepidation, I took up her offer. It wasn't an offer. It was a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Well, I don't know how to do this." And she said, "Okay, here's what you do. You go down." This was in the context of the year before. I was sure he didn't like me, so I didn't give him a tip at Christmas, which is really, really, really bad. If you live in a New York City apartment, I gave everybody else a tip, but not him.
Wow.
And so, okay, I felt bad about that. But part of me said, well, he doesn't like you, so why should you give him a tip? So then Christmas was coming up, and this was coming up in my personal coaching. And so she said, "You have to clear this up because you need to know whether you were justified in not giving him a tip, or, in fact, you should give him a tip this year." And so she helped me develop this thing that I was going to say, this little speech that went something like this: "Hi, I think the whole doorman staff does a fantastic job here, but I have this thought that I wanted to share with you that you don't really like me." And so I, you know, it horrified me to have to say this out loud, but I did. And, well, I was at least planning to. And And I wanted to know whether that was true, and I wanted to kind of clear the air because I didn't give you a tip last year, and so I need to talk to you about this. I still remember sitting in my bedroom that morning that I told myself I was going to do it, and I knew I would have to go down, and I was praying that there was nobody else walking past the front desk that morning because, you know, it's hard enough to have this conversation with your neighbors passing by. And so I said, okay, if there's somebody else there, I'm not going to do it. So I go downstairs, the doors open, and there's nobody there. And it was his day, so I knew he was there. So he was there, and so I went up to him, and I actually said this. I think that waste the doorman stuff is great, but I have this idea you don't like me. And, it, like, his eyes got really big. He said, oh, no. That's not true at all. He said, I try and be really, really professional. And there are other doormen, which is true, on the staff that are really friendly, and, you know, they try and they... And he said, I think they get it into the residents' business too much. So I try and be very quiet, very respectful. And I said, that's great. So I'm trying to take this in. He's trying to take in that one of the residents just told him that she thinks he doesn't like him. And I said, oh, that's great, and I'm so sorry for not giving you a tip last year. And he said, oh, that doesn't matter. I said, Merry Christmas, and I ran out of the building. And it was very difficult to do. It was very emotional. I didn't want to start crying when I was talking to him, but I almost did. But I have to say that I felt incredibly, incredibly proud of myself that I did that. Yeah, and something really miraculous happened after that incredibly awkward, horrible conversation that I got through. And that was every single day after that, we had a much better relationship. I clearly tried to be friendly and say hello to him, right. And he was very friendly to me. And it did resolve. But it took that horrible conversation to do.
And it's such a relatable story because I think all of us kind of, you know, have those kind of imaginative relationships. And they're such a source of stress.
They are.
In many ways. Well, you're a neuroscientist, and I love the science in this book. I mean, it's really a personal narrative, and it's a compelling narrative, especially the sections on your romantic endeavors, which I think are fascinating. But, you know, you're still a neuroscientist, and you still have done incredible research about, you know, on the hippocampus, and including some research that coattailed on the famous HM case of this patient who lost his hippocampus and couldn't form new memories at all. You can walk into the room, introduce yourself. He'd leave, and then he'd come back 2 minutes later, and you'd have to introduce yourself again because he had no idea who you were.
Yeah.
And what you did for this research, which I find it fascinating because I'm very familiar with that case, as many of us are, is that you show that it wasn't just the hippocampus, but it was also the tissue around the hippocampus that might have been responsible for his inability to create new memories. Fantastic. Your dissertation won one of the most prestigious prizes in all of neuroscience. You were a model for the great photographer Annie Leibovitz. I mean, you had an incredible career going on, but there was still something that was lacking, and there was just still something that just, I don't know, maybe was causing your brain to not function as healthily as it could. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I think this is another story that it's common in kind of people that are really focused on their career and successful people, that it's easy to get focused too much on one thing. And for me, it was on my career and on getting tenure at New York University, which really drove me to do nothing else but work and just go from my office, my apartment happened to be, you know, just blocks away from my lab, and so I would just there was a trench in the sidewalk between going back and forth, and spending all of my time in the lab. I knew nobody except the people in my lab and my colleagues. Yet at the same time, I was living in this amazing city, New York City, and I ate takeout so much in New York because it's so delicious, and gained 20 pounds because I wasn't doing anything except working and going home. And I only had a 2-block walk to get home. So there were a lot of things that ended up making me feel stressed and non-energized, and that something was really missing, that I was unhappy. I realized I was unhappy, despite the fact that I got awards and my research was going well. And, I had and still have my dream job.
All right.
But if you're not happy in a key part of your personal life, you can't be overall happy. And so that's what made me sit up and notice. And I didn't know how to change my very lackluster social life. But I did know how to lose weight.
Right,
I grew up
right.
in California. I played tennis and basketball growing up. And so I said, okay, easiest thing to do, I'm just going to go to the gym. And that was really the start of the reason why I wrote this book,
right, yeah.
is all of the things that I noticed about my personality, my brain function with this increase in exercise. And I got a trainer and I started going to a gym. And there's so many beautiful gyms in New York. That part was easy. But I started seeing these transformations, and that's a lot of what I describe in this book.
Yeah, and I'm talking to Dr. Wendy Suzuki, who just came out with Healthy Brain, Happy Life, a personal program to activate your brain and do everything better. A compelling narrative, your own story. The current research in neuroscience, from what I can gather from a layperson, is that there is a definite connection between exercise and brain health. And in many ways, that's kind of what this story is about, how that
yes.
exercise started to change your brain. How
yes.
is that possible? And why do you think so many people cannot conceive that if they want to improve their brain, they need to improve their bodies?
Well, because it's not in the popular literature as much. All of the information focuses on, get a beach-ready body by working out.
Right.
And, some people don't really want a beach-ready body. That is maybe not highest on list. Maybe all of us kind of want it, but,
right.
but not enough to actually go and sweat at the gym. But what I'm trying to change the kind of overall narrative to is the idea that physical movement can actually improve your brain. In fact, I'm working on an op-ed right now called Movement as Medicine. And I like to say movement instead of exercise, because exercise has such a negative connotation for people. It sounds like something you have to do, that you have to go and sweat with a whole bunch of people, and you may not like to do that. But movement is more neutral. And what all the neuroscience research is showing is that it can be as effective as certain, in fact, sometimes more effective than medicines that we have.
Mm-hmm.
It's well documented that exercise has a positive effect on mood. And it can be as effective as one of the most commonly used antidepressants in people with major depressive disorder. And even for somebody that isn't depressed, it will boost your mood, because what it does is increases levels of neurotransmitters that are typically decreased in depression, like serotonin, mm-hmm. noradrenaline, and dopamine. But it also has significant effects on your prefrontal cortex, important for your ability to shift and focus attention, as well as on the hippocampus. And that's the area that is my particular specialty, generally in neuroscience. And we know that exercise, from studies in animals, that exercise can stimulate the birth and survival of brand new brain cells in your hippocampus, which is huge. I mean, there's only 2 brain areas that we know in the entire brain which, as adults, we can stimulate new brain cells in. One is the olfactory bulb, important for olfaction. The other is the hippocampus, critical for memory.
Right.
And I don't know about you, but I want to get as many brand new brain cells in my hippocampus today as I can, as we age, it gets harder to improve the brain. So that's what lifelong exercise is doing, is stimulating. That's one of the things lifelong exercise is doing, stimulating the birth of lots of new brain cells in your hippocampus.
It's surprising how many people still believe that as you grow older, there's not much you can do for your brain, that your brain is just going to deteriorate more and more. But the concept of brain plasticity shows us that that's not true. And
absolutely.
In many ways, what you're teaching us is you're showing us exactly how brain plasticity works for you.
Yeah, exactly.
And if brain plasticity is the idea that nerves are growing in two parts of the brain, can still grow, and you can create new ones in the hippocampus and the olfactory bulb. The hippocampus, which is not only partly responsible for the creation of new memories, but in many ways it's responsible for moods, for the way you feel. And so
yes,
a happy, growing hippocampus is probably going to be a more progressive mood, a more positive mood than it would be. It would thrive less under a mood that is dismal and depressing. And also, I would imagine that if you have a positive attitude, that you're probably more likely to encode things into your brain, into your long-term memory, that are positive and that kind of feed that attitude rather than you would than if they were negative.
Yes, we certainly know that your mind state and your belief system have very important implications for how you remember things, how you learn things. So, yes.
You know what was interesting about this book? I think this book is going to be a sign of things to come. I think there's going to be a lot more books on neuroscience.
Yeah.
But I think what they're going to borrow from you, whether you like it or not, is that what happened to physics about 10 years ago, the popularization of physics, where all these books were coming out and suddenly there were particular thinkers or spiritual movements that used physics to justify their beliefs, saying, see, physics proves entanglement, physics proves this, physics proves, mm-hmm. you know, all this. I think that that might start happening with neuroscience, that we might start using neuroscience to justify certain spiritual beliefs, such as, for example, the power of, the intention that we hear from Wayne Dyer,
mm-hmm.
or the law of attraction, you know, the brain science can actually explain and justify this. Do you find that you're being quoted and being used to justify any kind of particular belief? Have you found that yet, or is that still
not
to come?
Not yet, I have to say. At least nobody's asked me directly about that. And the truth is that, these are fine questions to ask. One can address these questions scientifically with direct experiments. What's more shaky is if you say, well, I believe that this might happen when you do it. That's not an experiment.
Right, right.
But there's certainly ways to address these questions scientifically, and I welcome all approaches. That's
yeah.
the scientific method. And part of what I'm trying to kind of bring in this book is the idea that we can all be scientists. We can all kind of do these self-experiments that I've described and test ideas out. These are all hypotheses. Is exercise beneficial for me or is it not? Is meditation helping me or is it not? Is sleep, is certain number of hours of sleep, is that beneficial versus not? These are all experiments
that
I do on myself and that I think would benefit if people did that in a systematic way. And that's one of the things I could kind of bring from my years of study of science. Never realized I would do that, but bring it back onto my own self and onto my own life.
Absolutely. In fact, you kind of conclude this book in a sense by saying anyone can learn to think like a scientist.
Yes,
and that's
absolutely
a wonderful conclusion, because you're not saying anyone needs to do this, anyone needs to do intent santi, anyone needs to do anything,
no,
but that anyone can learn to think like a scientist.
Yes.
And I love the studies that you tell us about when it comes to meditation, what might be happening in the brain during meditation.
Yes.
And if all
yes.
these things do kind of justify or suggest, that certain ideas are right, more power to them. What would your number one goal for this book? What would you want people to get from this book?
I think the number one idea is that there are powerful things that you could easily add to your life today. They're free. You can do it immediately. That could have profound effects on your brain and how you experience your life. And the two that I'll highlight are physical movement / exercise. And again, you don't have to be a triathlete. You just have to start moving more and regularly. And the second one is meditation. It's a powerful message, and I'm devoting my research now, my whole research effort, to trying to understand the neuroscience underlying all these effects that I've noticed, and I'm sure there's more that we're going to uncover, right. But I think this is a profound observation that has implications for education, for work productivity in adults, and for aging, which is why I'm so excited about it.
I'm talking to Dr. Wendy Suzuki, author of Healthy Brain, Happy Life. And if you need motivation for going to the gym, all you need to do is read this book. Thank you very much, Dr. Suzuki, for joining us on Words on the Wire.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.